states that were in our data set. And so that's why we exclude the hospitals that are outside of the states that we include in our data set. But for those that are in the data set, we would be able to tell if patients were admitted outside of their home state.
Thank you. Leslie?
So I have a question where you might have two hospitals in the same community. One hospital is known as a brand for children's hospitals. It's not a children's hospital. It's just where most children go. Both hospitals would be very high-volume community hospitals, but one would display as a low-volume hospital, even though it wasn't in this case. Does this create any challenges where we might have the same sort of problem we've mentioned over and over again about low-volume hospital size and low volume overall when we just simply have a patient mix that's very different in an otherwise high volume hospital?
This is Mari Nakam. I want to make sure I understand your question. So you're wondering about the issue of a community hospital that has some pediatric patients but overall not a very high volume of pediatric patients,
correct,
perhaps compared to another hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So this is certainly a challenge about trying to measure pediatric readmission rates or any sort of hospital-based quality measure, that you're right, that there are big differences in the types of hospitals that care for children. What we found is that children tend to be really concentrated at relatively small numbers of hospitals, so they tend to be high volume, they tend to provide a full range of care, and then the community hospitals tend to provide care for relatively small numbers of children. To give you a sense, children's hospitals make up about 5% of all of the 4,000 hospitals in the country, but actually care for about a third of pediatric inpatients. And so I think where this is a challenge is that, as we've alluded to some, for these community hospitals, on the one hand, we didn't want to ignore them, but we also acknowledge that the reliability of their readmission rates is limited because of the low volume. And so one way that we think these hospitals could still be included is, of course, to be very responsible about explaining the limits and what we actually know about them, and also perhaps to compare like hospitals with like.
Thank you. Tony?
Yes, I just have a quick question about your databases from, you said, 26 states, I believe. Were they consistent in terms of the state populations? That's the first question. And the second follow-up would be, did you see any differences in states that had higher populations?
So to answer the question, this is Mari Nakamura again. To answer the question about population, the states actually varied quite a bit in population because we found that the states with the best data quality, fortunately, were geographically distributed, and so some of them were lower population states and other high. We didn't actually do an analysis to evaluate how the volume of the state related to readmission rates, and that's something we certainly would be able to do.
Thank you very much. Other comments? I would remind the group that, as with the previous measure on all-cause readmissions following vascular procedures, this would be a new measure. So if endorsed, the three-year period would ask some of these, that the developers generate some of the data that have been raised and issues of concern and so on. So if approved, right, it would be a new measure that we would ask the developers to consider some of these kind of response to some of these kinds of issues. Are we ready to vote validity? Go.
Voting for 2B validity, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. We have all the votes for 2B validity. 0 voted high, 19 voted moderate, 3 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Feasibility, Kathy?
Certainly these are claims data, so potentially feasible. I think it is worth mentioning, as Mari already did, that Medicaid, what's in Medicaid claims does vary from state to state, so that's a little bit of an issue. Having said that, they did test the measure on the New York database, and we're able to see a little bit of model fitting issues with rare values, but then they were able to offer some troubleshooting to address any issues of feasibility. So I think that's a strength.
Karen?
Yeah, I think feasibility is a real concern here because kids, unlike adults over 65, are covered by a whole bunch of different insurance plans. So, yeah, there's a chunk in Medicaid, but they certainly don't represent a randomly selected group of kids. And so understanding how this measure might act in all payer claims databases versus a Medicaid database versus Aetna or something like that, I think is something that would really need to be thought through as this is rolled out. Are we trying to build a Medicaid quality metric? Are we trying to build a pediatric quality metric? And I think those two things are probably different. And so I think the model and the measure would probably have to take that into account given the limitations of the pediatric data and the ways in which the populations that underlie those data might actually differ quite a bit.
Other comments or thoughts?
Thank you. This is Mari Nakamura again. Issue about the variation in Medicaid claims from state to state is certainly a true one. We anticipate that one of the likely uses for the measure will be by Medicaid programs. We know that's something that CMS is interested in. And at least initially, it seems that what would be most feasible is to evaluate readmission rates within a state rather than trying to compare across states. That said, it may be that as more measures come out for pediatrics, that this will perhaps drive the creation of a national data set that's available in a more timely way than the MACS data set. We also note that there are several states that are developing or already have all-payer claims data sets that could be useful for this measure. Again, that wouldn't necessarily allow national comparisons, but at least within state comparisons. One thing that we tried to do with our measure and have provided the SAS program for is we've provided a way for a given state Medicaid program to be able to calculate nationally comparable rates using our MACS data set as a reference data set. And so this is something that if a state Medicaid program really wanted to have a sense of how they compared to another state, that they would have the option to use. Regarding Karen's point about the fact that there are different insurers for children and that unlike the adult over 65 program, there's not a Medicare for children, this is very true. Medicaid covers about a third of hospitalized children, so it is a sizable portion, but she's absolutely right that those children are not necessarily directly comparable to children covered by other insurance plans. We've looked at insurance disparities and found, in fact, that Medicaid-insured children do have a higher risk of readmission. We know that there has been a lot of discussion about including such sort of sociodemographic factors, and if there was interest in including something like insurance status for pediatrics, we would be very interested in discussing that further.
Thank you. We're shading into usability here, so I'm going to ask Tom and then Larry.
Well, that was my question. Is this a feasibility issue or a usability issue? Are all your data from MACS data, and are you putting this out there as a Medicaid performance measure or a children's performance measure?
We are putting it out there as Mari Nakamura again, as a pediatric performance measure, but recognizing that one probably common use will be as a Medicaid performance measure. We were aiming to be as inclusive as we could. An example of another data set that could be used with our measure would be an all-payer claims data set at a state level. And so as part of our measure testing, we did work with the state of New York, as Kathy mentioned, to test the measures on their all-payer data set as well.
Thank you. This is a usability issue, we're still on feasibility. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say I now agree with Karen that there's a significant feasibility issue here based upon your response.
So feasibility for application across all I'm concerned about your issue. Let me have you guys reframe that as what is the actual nature of the concern about feasibility?
I'll defer to Karen.
I think it depends what you're trying to define it as. As a Medicaid measure, it is feasible for states to use because it's based on claims data.
So is your concern the target of inference here? The target of inference is the whole population.
As a pediatric measure, it's not super feasible because there are entire swaths of the population that are in no claims data set, which makes it very difficult to apply claims-based metrics to them. So I think it depends a little bit on the population that we're trying to assess, whether or not it is actually feasible to do. If you had a kid in
I don't know, Kansas. I don't know if Kansas is an all-payer claims data set covered by Aetna. I'm not sure that you actually could include that child in a metric. But for Medicaid, it's highly feasible because it's a claims base. It just depends on the group.
Larry? Jeroen?
It's an interesting sort of characterization of the feasibility question. The way that we generally think about it is, so if a state had an all-payer claims database, let's say California, for instance, and they wanted to be able to run this measure for their pediatric patients in their state, would they be able to do that? I think that's generally the way that we would look at it. So if they had the data, can they take these specifications and run them? And so I'll just open that. And if they can, I think that makes it a very feasible measure. I mean, if a user doesn't even have the data, that's not necessarily a feasibility question for the measure developer. So maybe I'll just, with that framing, maybe the measure developer can respond.
Yes, thank you. This is Mari Nakamura. So with that framing, we certainly think that the measure is highly feasible, that it's actually quite easy to implement. We have very detailed specifications, and we've also can provide programs to actually be able to do a lot of the data preparation and running of the model. So in our experience working with New York and in working with the programs ourselves, we feel like if you have the data, that it's highly feasible.
Thank you. Larry?
Quick comment, though. Was the model validated in all-payer data? And if not, although it may be feasible to use with all-payer data, it probably would not be a very appropriate use if it has not been validated using all-payer data.
It's true that our primary data set for development was Medicaid claims data, and so we've done the most testing absolutely in that data set. We did also, however, use a couple of states, HCUP state inpatient database data, to test the measures as well, and to be able to also, in the case of New York, to compare our findings with their findings on their all-payer claims data set.
So now I would like to ask NQF to comment on how we frame this, because the issue has become the target of inference here, and if we're trying to infer what the all-cause readmission rates for pediatrics are using the Medicaid database, that's a different issue I'm hearing that's a different issue than if you're trying to extrapolate to the entire pediatric population.
Well, I'll answer, but with a question, I guess. I mean, in some ways, when we look at not to draw comparisons with other measures, but you know, the Yale CMS measures that are, for instance, the all-cause hospital readmission measure, has been developed using the Medicare claims data, then tested with the California all-payer claims database. And it's specified as 18 and older. So the unit of inference could be any group of people that are over that population. In this case, it seems very similar to me. So I would say that, I mean, I'm not judging this, but I think you should keep that in mind as you make your decision about the feasibility of this measure.
Leslie?
So just a clarification, though. Didn't you already state that the research showed that there actually was a difference with the current Medicaid covered population, and that you saw right away that there was a difference in that insured population versus the other insured population? So therefore, we were starting the game with a difference in class of service, I guess, based upon the insurance. And so do we have mixed messages?
Thank you. This is Mari Nakamura. So, yes, you're correct that Medicaid-insured children have a higher readmission risk than privately insured children, for example. This would be one argument for why it might be important to eventually adjust for insurance status as part of the case mix adjustment. At the same time, go back to the analogy that Tarun made, we know that Medicare-insured adults over age 65 are at a higher risk of readmission than other adults. And so I think, as you're pointing out very well, the population that you're evaluating is a really important question, and it's important to be careful to consider who you compare But we don't feel that that limits the ability to use a measure either in a specific payer population or more broadly, but taking into account the fact that there are differences among different payers.
Okay, so I'm hearing some confusion about that. I think probably, although it does touch on feasibility for certainly the data you've run it, so you can get access to that data. And I think the issue now is shading over into usability, and that's causing a little bit of a concern around here. Although the feasibility issue, does anybody else want to make a comment on feasibility? Are we ready to vote? All right, let's vote.
Voting for feasibility, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. We have all the votes for feasibility. 3 voted high, 18 moderate, 1 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Now we're into usability. And does anybody have further comments on the potential usability of this issue? 1, 2. Kathy, you want to go first?
I think it's just worth noting the potential differences between what is an unplanned readmission and actual preventable readmission. I think there's a decent amount of angst in the pediatric hospital medicine community that there may not be a lot we can do broadly to prevent readmission, although I would personally comment it's still early in the game. It's still a little hard to actually come down on whether or not that's true or not. There are certainly large groups trying to reduce readmission rates nationally, and frankly, the studies that they have done haven't yet been published, so I think it's just early to assess, but I think it's a consideration is whether or not how much of this is actually preventable versus unplanned.
Paul?
Along similar lines, I do have significant concerns that there's not a credible rationale for improvement. I know looking through the background that there have been almost no studies of interventions, but it doesn't seem like there's either been, or maybe you can tell me if there are some studies that at least correlating certain hospital practices with better readmission rates, even though there wasn't an obvious randomization or experimental design. And without that, it seems, and given that pediatrics, I think, is significantly different from adults with multiple chronic diseases, a large number of medications, it would seem that your interventions you would do would be different. And so I'm very concerned that it's not clear how hospitals will be able to use the information once it's released.
Developers want to comment?
Yes, thank you. This is Mari Nakamura. To start with Kathy's point about preventability versus unplanned readmissions, we agree that ideally it would be desirable to be able to assess preventable readmissions rather than unplanned readmissions. We just don't think that that's possible using claims data, using the data that we currently have widely available to us. And so we took the approach in harmony with what has been done in adult measures to instead focus on unplanned readmissions. That said, research that we're currently working on as well as conducted at other institutions has indicated that a sizable proportion of unplanned readmissions actually are potentially preventable. Of course, how preventability is determined is highly controversial. It's something that I think will probably always be a subject of debate because it's so subjective. We have a study that's still currently underway in which we've talked with patients, families, nurses, outpatient doctors, inpatient doctors to try to get a sense from all of them of how preventable they thought readmissions were. What we found is the more information you get, the better sense that you get, but that it's a very complicated question. And so knowing that we are using claims data for this measure, we're choosing to focus on unplanned readmissions. Regarding the rationale for whether readmission rates can be improved in pediatrics, it is indeed true that there are far fewer studies in pediatrics than adults looking at interventions for readmission. There are a handful that have focused on pediatric patients or that have included pediatric patients and evaluated them as a subset that have found, for example, better adherence to practice guidelines has been associated with reduced readmissions or improvements in criteria for discharge. All that said, we acknowledge that in this space for pediatric measures that more likely what we're dealing with is a rationale that makes sense rather than a lot of evidence already in the literature. And we believe that given that processes such as discharge preparation and education, making sure that there are good transitions to the community are felt to be equally important in pediatrics, that improvements in those processes could also lead to improvements in readmission rates. The point that there are not as many very chronically ill complex patients among pediatric patients as adults is true. That said, one of my colleagues at our center conducted a study a couple years ago examining specifically the population of patients with chronic complex conditions and who are frequently readmitted, and found that while they're a small percentage of all patients, they account for a high percentage of readmissions and cost. And so in terms of a population that could be a focus for readmission improvement, that seems like a natural one. Thank you.
Thank you. Tarun, do you have something specific to this? Okay, then let's go. Leslie, Karen, and Tarun.
So this is an interesting area in usability and maybe should be questioned or comments aimed towards implementation. But communication and education around this measure could not be stressed more, because readmission is something that is known in the public, I guess, consciousness. And now we apply the highly emotional area of pediatrics, and without good explanation and the fact that we have data sources coming from Medicaid patients that we've already felt that are disenfranchised by other payer groups, we have the potential to have a good deal of angst associated with this measure released. And so I would just caution and encourage that along with the implementation guide, we include communications plans and education for the public.
Certainly, this is one of those ones that, if approved, the MAP is going to have something to say a lot about. So, Karen?
I just have two additional thoughts about the usability. Both, again, perhaps not things that would keep the measure from going forward, but things that I think would be particularly essential in this population to consider. And one is socioeconomic status. I don't think you can get away from that in this population. And especially because you've shown data that shows us that there's a big difference there. Not necessarily to adjust for it, but it's got to be part of the discussion about how we think about this and how it sort of rolls out. Because if we're just identifying hospitals that differ by socioeconomic status, I don't think we're doing anyone a favor. And the second is admission rates. We've talked about this with the adult measures as well. If a community works to reduce their admission rates for asthma, they could potentially increase their readmission rates. And I think that would be equally true for the complex chronic condition patients. If you put a good intervention in place to improve their care as outpatients, they might not go into the hospital as much. And I would hate to see hospitals look worse on readmissions because they have done such a good job of providing good outpatient care for their patients. I just don't think the long-term quality here is just about readmission. It's also got to be about admission. That's where this stuff is moving. And I would really encourage, as we think about usability, think about some sort of companion way to examine that piece.
Thank you. Tarun?
Just to follow up on the question of the all-payer claims and the MAX data, I just wanted to clarify from the developer, is the information that's provided in the testing form, that's the testing from the MAX data set, right?
This is Mari Nakamura. Yes, that's right.
Is there information that you can share with the committee around the testing from the New York State all-payer claims database that you've done?
What we would be able to provide is a sense of what the readmission rates look like, how they compare to the Medicaid readmission rates. We also specifically used our all-payer data sets to be able to evaluate some questions that we couldn't in MAC, so specifically insurance status and also the relationship between insurance status and race ethnicity as risk factors for readmission. That said, we did not do all of the testing in the all-payer data set that we did with the MAX data set, in part because we were limited in the all-payer data set to not as many states, and we felt that the MAX data set was actually far larger, and although it was limited to Medicaid patients, based on the power that we had, the more desirable data set to use as our primary development data set.
Thank you. We're over time for this measure by a considerable amount. On the other hand, since this is the first of its kind, I feel like this was a very good discussion of the kinds of issues that are problematic. With respect to Medicaid status and Karen's issue about socioeconomic status, if you use it as an adjuster, you're adjusting away the thing you're trying to explain. So it's kind of, it's one of these problematic areas that, once again, we are faced with, here's new ground, we're faced with the measure we have in front of us, not the one we would like to develop 5-10 years hence. So staring at the thing you're staring at, this issue we're now preparing to vote for. Any other comments?
I do. I'm not an expert in feed data, and I'm still not sure what I've heard. So a couple of the experts maybe could comment. The extrapolatability from Medicaid to the general population sounded like there were concerns about it. We could have solved in my head. Those still exist. Anybody want to?
Yeah, I think the tough thing about this, I'm just trying to summarize what I've heard and what I know, is that ideally, the first measure for pediatric care would probably be more related to access to care, especially primary care and surveillance. It wouldn't be about hospital services. Children have the lowest overall admission rate of any cohort seen in the emergency department, for example, in terms of unscheduled admissions or readmissions. So in a perfect policy development world, you wouldn't start with the hospital piece. You'd probably end with it. The other fundamental problem, which we touched on yesterday, is that the place you need to move the rock with the most urgency are the very states where you're going to have the poorest Medicaid data and the smallest number of children who should be getting better primary care eligible for Medicaid services. So it's a fundamental conundrum because, as with other applications of administrative data, this is an easy place to start. It may be the only place to start, but it's not the best place to start.
Thanks, Kathy.
I would comment that I agree with you that certainly some aspects of pediatric readmission are hinge upon things like access to care, although I don't think that that's all of it. And certainly, I think it's a real question of whether or not hospitals can truly move this metric, although it seems like with a new metric, the standard is to reassess in 3 years and see whether or not they were if there was any change in time. But then I would just also, I think to me the bigger question is what Bruce raised, which is it's primarily based on Medicaid data, and how it extracts beyond Medicaid is still a little bit of a question mark in my mind.
I would just add, from a non-physician, non-provider standpoint, it isn't a good idea if children are readmitted to the hospital. So the idea that readmission to the hospital is a quality measure is not a stretch for me. I mean, the question is rather, as Bruce alluded to, who are we extrapolating to from who are we actually able to measure this on? And that remains a difficulty. On the other hand, we are, again, right, Tarun, we have in front of us, and that's what we're considering.
We're looking where the light is.
No, Tarun wants to say something.
Leslie.
When I guess my concern about the Medicaid data is somewhat helped by the thought that if we help the poor, we help everyone.
Okay. Oops. Go ahead.
I guess this is just a clarification because I might have gotten confused along the way. If this measure is fully tested in the Medicaid population with the validity testing and not fully tested in the all-payer or in other settings, when we approve it, it will say it was tested in the Medicaid population, Is that, how does that affect how it is used out of the portfolio? Because usually, if I remember correctly, we've always said that it's endorsed based on how it's specified and how it's tested, I think, was the second part of that. So I'm just trying to ask for clarification on that.
It's not specified to be exclusively used in Medicaid. It is, the details reveal that it was tested on Medicaid. So my interpretation is that it would not be limited to application in Medicaid, but then in follow-up, we would, somebody would see how it performs. Tarun, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, and I think that's, that seems to be the conundrum that you've raised, which started this conversation, which is that it's not specified. The testing doesn't match completely the specifications. So if it were to be used outside of Medicaid, you know, it's specified to be able to do that, though the testing doesn't demonstrate how it would perform outside of Medicaid.
So are we close to ready? It's my understanding that if you did nothing else, you would overestimate the amount of the readmission rates by hospital. And then the question is whether or not that overestimation would compromise its usability for when measures got less and less stable because the numbers got smaller and smaller for readmission rates. So that could be addressed in a use if approved.
Thank you. This is Mari Nakamura. You're correct that readmission rates will tend to be higher in a Medicaid-only population, we found, than in an all-payer population. There are some different sort of considerations at work in going from a Medicaid-only to an all-payer data set. So, for example, we would anticipate that for many hospitals, the sample sizes used would actually get better because while Medicaid is a sizable portion of all hospitalizations, it's only about a third, and of course that will differ depending on the proportion of Medicaid at a given hospital, but if anything, we would expect that reliability would improve and that the precision of rates would actually get better.
Gotcha. The numerator would bump up. Okay, so we...
I think the numerator would get better, but fundamentally you're drawing coefficients out of a higher risk population, which means you're less likely to hold a hospital accountable that has a lower risk population.
This is Mari Nakamura. Thank you for that question because I hadn't realized, I apologize, part of the concern here. So the way that our measure is run is that actually we don't provide the beta coefficients as set numbers to be used in the model. Instead, the model is actually run on the data set to which it's being applied, and new coefficients for that particular population are generated. So I agree that the choice of covariates we made certainly was based primarily on the Medicaid data set. We did test the very same model on our all-payer data set, and we believe that in terms of the relationships between things like age and gender and chronic conditions that one can generalize from the Medicaid population to an all-payer data set in terms of those fixed effects relationships, while recognizing that at the same time having Medicaid insurance as a child appears an additional risk factor on top of those patient characteristics.
Thank you.
Fair enough. Oops, Kathy.
Do you have a sense of what the C statistic was in the all-payer model? Is it the same?
This is Mari Nakamura. No, I'm sorry, I don't have that, although we would be able to easily determine that.
Okay. I think we are ready to vote on the issue of, usability.
Voting for usability and use, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient information, and the time starts now. We have all the votes for usability and use. 0 high, 14 moderate, 8 low, 0 insufficient information.
Thank you. And drum roll, we are now to endorsement. Any more further thoughts? Okay.
Voting for overall suitability for endorsement. 1 is yes, 2 no. Time begins now. We have all the votes for overall suitability for endorsement. Measure 2393, pediatric all-condition readmission measure. The votes are 17 yes, 5 no.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the developers. Now we are 20 minutes behind, and so we are going to have to sort of make tracks. I assume that much of the discussion will now sharpen up and condense itself around many of either not similar issues but possibly easier to deal with issues. So would you reintroduce yourselves for the record and then describe the measure?
Thank you. This is Mari Nakamura from Boston Children's Hospital.
This is Leslie from Harvard Medical School.
And we have Mark Schuster on the phone. I'll keep my introduction brief because by design these two measures are very similar, and so for the most part the same considerations apply. Our pediatric lower respiratory infection measure evaluates readmissions following an index hospitalization for bronchiolitis, influenza, or community-acquired pneumonia. We decided on a measure focusing on lower respiratory infections because they're among the most common reasons for hospitalization in children. In addition, they're among the diagnoses with the most prevalent readmissions. We found an overall 30-day readmission rate of 5.6%, which corresponds with a large absolute number of readmissions given the high number of initial hospitalizations for lower respiratory infection. We prioritized harmonizing this measure with NQF-endorsed adult readmission measures as well as with our all-condition measure, and as a result, the approaches we used in developing the measure are very similar. We used the same case mix adjustment model because we found that it performs very well for LRI readmissions with regard to discrimination and calibration. The issue of limited reliability due to small sample sizes is even more of an issue for any condition-specific rate, and this is true for LRI, than for all condition rates. But again, we found that a majority of children were cared for at higher volume hospitals, and as a result, were at hospitals with good reliability. The New York Office of Safety and Quality also tested this measure on its Medicaid and all-payer databases and noted that having implemented one measure, it was required minimal effort to be able to implement the other. And so we do think that this measure could be a useful tool to evaluate quality and encourage improvements in care for an important pediatric condition. Thank you.
Thank you. I think Mari is the only person in the room that talks faster than I do, so thank you very much for that quick summary. Joanne, do you want to talk to us about evidence?
I'll go ahead and get started with this. As was said, this is a companion measure to the one we just discussed, and looking at lower respiratory infections, accounting for a large number of the readmissions we see, it is an important area, and there's good support here on how these readmissions, we may be able to look at things to improve, and improve the readmissions, looking at our key processes, our discharge planning, care transitions, appropriate follow-up, et cetera. And disparities exist for many of these differences we see in patients being readmitted for lower respiratory infection.
Thank you, Karen. Kathy, nothing to add? Others? Vote evidence?
Voting for 1A, evidence, 1 yes, 2 no. Time begins now. We have all the votes for 1A, evidence. 19 voted yes, 2 voted no.
A performance gap, Joanne?
There exists a performance gap for this. This is also a newly commissioned measure by CMS and AHRQ. There's disparities in care across populations in many different ways, and there are strong data to support that there is a quality gap and a need for this measure. There is support in the application talking about some of the pediatric data that's out there, although it is not as rich as the adult data, but the appropriate rationale is there.
Kathy?
Just comment, though, that the readmission rate for the lower respiratory tract infections is actually lower than the all-cause, and so it's hard to know what the how much of a range we're actually dealing with at the different hospitals, like what the interquartile range would be for the risk standardized rate and whether or not that's significant.
Do the developers have any information for us?
This is Mari Nakamura. Yes, thank you. So for our lower respiratory infection measure, to give you analogous numbers to what I provided for all condition, a hospital that's two standard deviations below the mean would have a readmission rate of 1.7%. A hospital two standard deviations above would have a readmission rate of 12.6%. So there's actually a wider range for lower respiratory infection.
Thank you for that. Others? Okay, ready to vote? Performance gap.
Voting for 1B, performance gap, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and the time begins now. We have all the votes for performance gap. 3 voted high, 18 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Priority? Joanne?
And this continues to be a high priority measure as it was commissioned by AHRQ and CMS, also because it relates and impacts a large number of pediatric patients and accounts for a large number of the readmissions in the hospital.
Thank you. Kathy?
Yeah, just lower respiratory tract infections are one of the most common indications for hospitalization in pediatrics, so to me it's high priority.
Others? Ready to vote?
Voting for 1C, high priority, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. Just one more vote. We have all the votes for 1C, high priority. 12 voted high, 8 moderate, 1 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you very much. Scientific acceptability. Start with reliability. Joanne?
Yeah, this measure was tested the exact same way as the previous measure using the MAX data. And when we looked at reliability, it ranged between 0.7 to 0.5 to 0.77. The measure was also found to be highly reliable in hospitals with an adequate sample size, but obviously it did not perform as well in those with a lower sample size. And one of the questions was, will exclusions make reliability across time and place an issue for this measure? Because there's a large number of exclusions in this measure.
This is Mari Nakamura. Regarding exclusions, the one difference with our all-condition measure is the case definition requirement for the index hospitalizations. So speaking more generally about both measures, I think that we've created an appearance of maybe more exclusions than typical because we listed everything in terms of being exclusion rather than some as inclusions. So some of these are, for example, based on limiting to the pediatric age range, some other common exclusions that we saw have been used quite uniformly in adult measures, such as excluding patients who leave AMA or certainly patients who die in the hospital. Our other sets of exclusions that are quite similar to the adult readmission measures are certain data quality exclusions for key variables with missing or what look like poor quality data, for example, a discharge date that occurs before a date of birth. The main clinical exclusions that we apply for both measures are, first of all, patients who are receiving obstetric care with the rationale that these patients are typically not under the purview of pediatrics, even if they fall in the pediatric age range. And so we felt would most likely be better included in obstetric measures rather than a pediatric measure. We also exclude patients with a primary mental health diagnosis. That is consistent with other measures, but in our own testing as well, we felt it was justified because we found that readmission performance for a given hospital does not track for mental health conditions as compared with other conditions. And then finally, we exclude newborns who are in the hospital for their birth admission. The clinical rationale for that is that they are among all patients in the hospital, not actually there because they're ill, but rather for another life event. And so we felt that it made sense not to include them in a readmission rate.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the committee to hold that consideration for the validity discussion as opposed to unless those exclusions change the reliability, we need to keep focused on reliability. Kathy?
I would just comment, as Mari already acknowledged, the reliability in this metric is not quite as good as the previous measure, in that only 229 of the 1743 hospitals actually had a readmission rate reliability of greater than 0.5, but that, again, these hospitals accounted for 62% of the lower respiratory tract infection hospitalizations, so it's still, even though it's a smaller number of hospitals, it's still a majority of the hospitalizations.
The precision of those estimates, once again, sort of tracks with everything else we're seeing. In fact, it lands a little bit on the higher side compared to other reliability estimates we've been seeing in some of these other measures. Anybody else? Vote reliability.
Voting for 2A reliability. 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. We're still waiting on two more votes. One more. All votes are in for 2A reliability. The results are 1 high, 18 moderate, 2 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Validity, and I'll ask you to keep in mind the exclusion discussion we just had.
Okay. On the validity, the construct validity was demonstrated as associated with the literature and the quality of care, the processes related to reductions in readmissions that we're all aware of. Criterion validity was shown using a data set from Boston Children's Hospital over a one-year period, and the sensitivity and the specificity were 87.0 and 99.7%, respectively. They also did face validity on the plan procedure algorithm that was completed and also received public comments from the Federal Register, and they then took those comments and put those into the methodology to improve it. And those would be my comments.
Sure. So very similar issues with validity in terms of identifying unplanned readmissions is as appropriate. The couple questions that I – well, so I'd say that the model calibration is good and the C statistic for predictive ability was 0.71, so that's in reasonable range. The one question that we were just talking about is how CF exacerbations come into play here, whether or not the model – would adequately account for CF as well.
This is Mari Nakamura. So cystic fibrosis in particular would end up being included in the model as one of the chronic condition indicator variables for chronic respiratory infections. But this is also an opportunity, I'll be very brief, to mention that we thought about whether we needed to have more specific variables for chronic conditions for the LRI measure versus the L condition, and in reflecting, decided not to because it's actually a wide range of conditions that place patients at higher risk of severe lower respiratory infections, so not just respiratory, but, for example, cardiac, neurological, and so we felt it made sense to keep all of the chronic condition indicators and found, indeed, that the model actually performs very well.
Thank you. I want to ask for a point of clarification about criterion validity because that implies a gold standard. You weren't using Boston Children's as the criterion. Did I misunderstand that? How is what you did criterion validity?
This is Mari Nakamura. So we were using the electronic health record data as our gold standard based on having performed detailed chart reviews of the cases that we evaluated with the idea that such a chart review is at least a better standard than what can be found from claims data in terms of being able to assess both whether a readmission occurred as well as whether it met our definition for an eligible readmission, meaning that it wasn't for a planned procedure or chemotherapy.
Thank you. That some of us would call that convergent validity because it converges with a different data source, but as opposed to criterion validity, but that's okay.
Thank you.
Other comments on validity? Let's vote.
2B validity, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. One more vote. All votes are in for 2B validity. 0 voted high, 20 moderate, 1 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Feasibility?
And on feasibility, I would say that since it's claims data, it's easily feasible for us to get these data. The one question, some of the concerns we've already had, is that it's based on Medicaid data, but it is feasible as claims data.
Kathy, no. Others? So we're burned out on feasibility. Ready to vote?
Voting on feasibility, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time begins now. Still waiting on 2 more votes. All votes are in for feasibility. The results are 3 high, 17 moderate, 1 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. On to usability.
Yeah, usability, since this measure is really a subset of the previous measure, all the issues we've discussed with usability in the previous discussion are the same here.
Kathy?
So, yeah, again, just the whole issue of preventability versus unplanned is a consideration, but that's the same as the other metric. The one thing that I would comment might be different for this metric compared to the other metric is this is lower respiratory tract infection is a very seasonal illness, and so, therefore, as is written, I think it's not an issue because it's an annual evaluation, but it's something that, like, it would not be appropriate to use for it to be used as a quarterly evaluation because of this seasonal variability in this, but I see it as written as fine.
Want to respond to that? No.
Thank you. This is Mari Nakamura. Kathy's correct that if we were to try to report these data or these results as quarterly, that season would be a really important consideration. We chose to make it annual, taking care of that fact, but also recognizing that quarterly rates would be an even greater challenge with regard to sample size.
Thank you. Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting on usability and use, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient information. The time begins now. All votes are in for usability and use. The results are 0 high, 17 moderate, 4 low, and 0 insufficient information.
Are we ready to vote on endorsement? Any discussion? Hearing none.
My only comment is that I think this one is very specific to sociodemographic data as well, and we need to consider that as we move forward with this down the road.
Yeah, the issue of sociodemographic data, as we've discussed yesterday and today, is going to be, you know, one of these things that is going to be guided by a committee that hasn't yet kind of given its guidance to us. So we are going to either endorse or not endorse the, right.
understanding that we can all as a group express that we want our NQF colleagues to capture that for these two measures, the group in particular felt very strongly that this question needs to be addressed in the future. Do people feel that's a relative consensus? Anyone would object to attaching that comment?
No, but and the issue of Medicaid and SES adjustment is one of these things that's also going to present a rather dodgy problem because socioeconomic status and some of the adult measures actually use Medicaid status as a proxy for socioeconomic status. So it's going to be a more complex issue with some of these measures.
So all I'm suggesting is we create a bit of a flag for our NQF colleagues that if someday comes where the white paper recommendations have changed on this, that this is an easy flag to spot.
So flag age approved and then associated recommendations. Are we ready to any other comments before we vote for endorsement or non-endorsement?
Voting for overall suitability for endorsement, one yes, two no. Time starts now. All votes are in for overall suitability for endorsement for measure 2414, pediatric lower respiratory infection readmission measure. The results are 18 yes and 3 no.
Thank you very much. And now we are ready for NQF member and public comment, and we will invite public comment. Thank you to the developers for a nice summary and discussion. We're on to the NQF member and public comment. I'm going to turn it over to Adela.
Kathy, can we compile the list, please?
Yes, ma'am. So if you would like to make a public comment, please press star, then the number one. There are no public comments at this time.
Got one behind us. Do we have any public comment in the room?
We've got somebody coming.
Oh. Hello?
Good afternoon, or I guess it's the morning, and I realize I'm standing between you and lunch. My name is Ellen Schwellenstecker. I'm with the Children's Hospital Association. And I just wanted to highlight some of the discussion among the committee that I just think is really important, some of which is outside your purview. But we've been saying for a long time that it's really important to develop good pediatric measures. And I want to thank the Center of Excellence at Boston Children's Hospital for their work in developing these measures. I'm not sure, and this may be a question for you, what the three-year experience sort of guidelines are. I do strongly agree with the recommendation on should the NQF change its policy on adjustment for SES and other factors, that it would be really important to look at these measures as well as adult readmissions measures in those in that light. I also think because of the lack of a large set of good pediatric measures, it will really be important to have other measures available before these kinds of measures are used for, say, accountability purposes or pay for performance. And so I'm wondering if that's sort of part of the three-year process to give us more chance for validation of measures against other measures, I guess that's convergent validity. And I know there are some other measures coming for that will be coming forward from the CHIPRA Centers of Excellence, which we just think is a really important program and are glad to see the measures coming to NQF.
So I can address that, Ellen, right now. So the NQF reevaluates all of its measures that are recommended for endorsement in a three-year maintenance cycle. In that three-year maintenance cycle, we look for experience on the measure. In particular, in the importance to measure criteria, we're looking for some performance gap information. We're not just looking conceptually whether there's a measure performance gap. We want to see the performance gap in the measure itself.
and to see the distribution and if there's, you know, any overall gap in performance or overall less than optimal performance. And then also in the use and usability criteria, we want to see if the measure has been implemented for use in quality improvement applications and then the further timeline is ready for accountability applications, which we include public reporting in that domain. So the purpose there is that we have measures that are actually picked up by the field and we can demonstrate that, that they're actually being used for the purposes of quality improvement and reporting the information to the public.
Just wanting to add, again, if this measure is endorsed and goes through the entire process, again, the SES issue, I think, outstanding. We don't know how that's all going to play out, but I think certainly we'll have to make a decision with our CSEC and our board, depending on how that lands, in terms of whether we'll bring measures back sooner than the 3-year time frame for maintenance, if, in fact, there are additional issues to address. But, you know, a very important piece of this is as these measures are going out there, you know, NQF endorsement does imply they are appropriate for any accountability application and could get picked up for any of those, certainly by CMS or others. We would really encourage the field to be really vigilant about keeping track of measures that are really helping to drive improvement, measures for which there may be unintended consequences, and bring that forward and that information in real time rather than just waiting for the 3-year limit.
Are there any other public comments?
Once again, to make a public comment, please press star 1. I have a comment from John Muldoon with 3 Health Information.
Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, several comments, and I submitted a lengthy, quite detailed set of comments about a month ago, but in terms of the concept of readmissions, the risk adjustment and the testing and the evaluation work and just highlight some concerns that we had identified, and some of these came up during discussion as well. The approach focuses on unplanned readmissions as opposed to trying to identify potentially preventable and realize that that's a tough challenge to identify, but there's a number of consequences because there are a number of very low preventability readmissions, such as malignancy-related admissions, the neutropenia, aplastic anemia. It's just an easy one to highlight, and those kinds of kids are treated at certain centers. So it creates numbers that may not be that real in terms of preventability and distortions in terms of comparisons across different settings. Also, when you go out to 30 days, the number of unrelated and low preventability readmissions increases, so that compounds the concern on the approach to readmissions. On the risk adjustment, we're concerned that often the principal diagnosis and the acuity of the admission, and it's really complex chronic conditions that have a very big impact on admission rates and readmission rates, and that's not very specifically addressed. It's more of a generic approach to any chronic condition from a list of about 4,500 mild, moderate, and severe, many of which have very little influence over admissions and readmissions. So we're concerned that that's not picking up the readmission factors very well. And in terms of testing and evaluation, I don't think we really saw it tested across different subgroups of pediatric patients and across different hospitals who serve different populations. So I think there's a lot that we don't know and need to be concerned about as it gets rolled out, if it's endorsed. And just to illustrate, for lower respiratory infections for the pediatric population, those with major chronic conditions. We've done a lot of research and analysis on this, such as cystic fibrosis, as the committee discussed, bronchopulmonary dysplasia, ventilator-dependent patients, chronic respiratory failure. They tend to have readmission rates in the 10 to 15% range compared to otherwise healthy children in the 3 to 5% range. And we just don't see how that can be teased out with the more generic risk adjustment method. So those are the thoughts that we'd like to share. And if the committee does endorse, I think there's a lot of cautions to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other comments on the phone?
At this time, there are no public comments from the phone line.
There are no other public comments in the room.
I think we can break for lunch then. Just a quick note for those who weren't here yesterday, we would ask the audience members to wait for the committee members to grab their lunch first before helping yourself.
So we'll reconvene at 12:15.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for eating so quickly and aiding the cause. We have three measures left this afternoon, one from the American College of Cardiology and two from Yale CMS. And then we have a very important brief update on measure 1789. So we're hoping we'll still have faces around the table when we get to that point. We'll ask the American College of Cardiology representatives to introduce themselves and briefly introduce their measure, please.
Hi, this is Jeffrey Curtis from Yale, also representing the ACC today.
Hang on, I'm not sure we heard that. Can you?
Sorry, Jeffrey Curtis from Yale, representing ACC today.
So Dr. Curtis will be speaking primarily to the measure methodology, but I'm Laura Slattery, ACC Senior Director for Scientific Reporting, and I can address any questions related to implementation.
So for endorsement maintenance today, under review is the hospital 30-day risk standardized readmission rates following percutaneous coronary intervention. It is a measure that was endorsed, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago, and identifies unplanned readmission rates for hospitals that perform percutaneous coronary interventions on Medicare fee-for-service patients greater than 65 years old. As I mentioned, this is unplanned readmissions, and we've updated the measure from the initial endorsement to include a modified version of the hospital-wide readmission algorithm that identifies unplanned readmissions, basically including a larger number of, or considering a larger number of readmissions planned. In addition, we've updated the measure to include the use of direct as opposed to indirect identifiers to match the CAF-PCI registry data with the CMS information about readmission, which is used to identify the risk standardized rates. And it has also, in the interim, actually gone into implementation. And last March, the hospitals received their reports as to their risk standardized readmission rates. And then there was a voluntary public reporting of those rates on Hospital Compare, as well as the ACC's internal websites, so that this information has, or this measure has progressed from development to approval to implementation in a relatively short time frame. And I think it's open for questions.
Thank you very much. We will start with the category of evidence, and our lead discussants are May and Larry, so I invite them to kick it off.
I'll go ahead and start. In terms of evidence to support the measure focus, the measure developers present evidence that there is a high level of variation across hospitals, which to me represents strong evidence. When you have variation in outcomes, that means that there's the potential to improve your outcomes, assuming that you've properly adjusted for differences in case mix. So I think the evidence is strong.
May said she agreed, but I didn't. Is your mic working?
I agree.
Okay, great. Any other comments on evidence? Okay, we'll move to vote.
Voting for 1A, evidence. 1 is yes, 2 is no, and the time begins now. Yes and zero no.
Moving into the performance gap opportunity.
In terms of the performance gap, without risk adjustment, the difference between the lowest decile and the highest decile was 0% readmission rates versus 28% readmission. After risk adjustment, difference between 10th percentile and 90th percentile was 13.5 versus 10.1%. So, again, evidence of a significant performance gap.
Additional comments? Okay.
Voting for 1B, performance gap, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and your time starts now. All votes are in for performance gap. 17 high, 4 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Priority.
In terms of priority, this is one of the conditions that was identified as a high priority condition by MedPAC. The overall incidence of readmissions within 15 days was 10%, which represents roughly about 44,000 readmissions in 2005 at a cost of $360 million annually. So I would suggest that this is a high priority condition.
Additional comments? See none.
Voting for 1C, high priority. 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and time begins now. Three more votes. All votes are in for 1C, high priority, 18 high, 3 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient.
Scientific now, reliability and validity.
In terms of reliability
first.
Data reliability, this is based on clinical data, which is audited using annual on-site chart reviews and data abstraction. In terms of model reliability, the intraclass correlation coefficient was 0.37, which is indicative of fair agreement and very much in the zone of the other measures that we have looked at over the past 2 days.
Additional comments? See none.
Voting for 2A reliability, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and the time starts now. One more vote. All votes are in for 2A reliability, 5 high, 16 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Validity.
In terms of validity testing, in terms of looking at the statistical performance of the model, the discriminant ability, the C statistic, was 0.66. Actually 0.67 in the validation data set, which is very good for this kind of a model. Model calibration was also very good. They looked at this using both graphical techniques and other approaches as well. In terms of threats to validity, 29% of the observations were missing data on ejection fraction. Ejection fraction is considered to be a very important clinical risk factor for these types of models. They imputed the missing data, but they used a very rough approach, I guess, for imputation. And I quote, "We stratified by gender and imputed the missing values to the median of the corresponding groups." So state of the art for imputation is to use multiple imputation. I was a little surprised that this approach was used, and I was wondering if the measure developers could maybe comment on this.
Yeah, I mentioned we've been on this journey for 5 or 6 years, so sometimes it's a little hard to reconstruct exactly what the logic was from that long ago. Nevertheless, there are two aspects to, first, why EF is missing so frequently, and second, our approach to accounting for the information that's conveyed by the missing data. So first off, the LVEF is specified to be an ejection fraction that an information about ejection fraction that is available prior to the performance of the PCI. So we obviously don't want to, if a PCI goes wrong and the patient has a large MI, has a low EF, we don't want to account for that in the model. So it has to be LVEF prior to the PCI. The patients who don't have information about an ejection fraction before the PCI typically are those that are being done on an urgent or emergent basis. So it is very much collinear with patients who have an ST elevation MI, patients with cardiogenic shock or other highly morbid conditions. And for that reason, it's certainly not missing at random. To account for that, in addition to imputation, we actually also have a dummy variable in the model for missing LVEF. So that aggregates both those patients in whom it's missing at random as well as those in whom it is missing not at random, i.e. that they had an emergent procedure, but it does account for the information that runs or is collinear with missingness. So we don't ignore the information that's conveyed by that. In terms of the single versus multiple imputation, that's something that I think a decision that we made a long time ago that was consistent with the inpatient mortality model for ACC. And so for that reason, I think we were trying to be harmonized in terms of how our approach. It's something that we could relook at or modify going forward. There's no reason that we couldn't do it from a statistical standpoint.
So in my mind, this remains a bit of a threat to validity. Some people would contest that if you're missing this much data on a particular covariate, that it shouldn't even be included in the model. And usually people typically, if you're missing more than about 10%, maybe 20% of the data, that's grounds for sometimes not including it in the model. The reference was made as to whether it's missing at random, missing not at random, without getting into a lot of the technical details. What lots of folks will do in this particular setting is they will create a regression model based on all the other available risk factors to predict the missing values for patients who have missing values. If you can do this, if you can predict a missing value using available covariates, then it is missing at random. And I would suggest that probably in many of these cases you could do that, that the data actually is missing at random as opposed to not missing at random. And I do think that is a bit of a threat to validity. Missing completely at random would be if it was just, well, I don't want to get into too much of the details on this, but I think it is an issue.
Jeff, had you indicated that it was, or did I misunderstand that you said it was somewhat collinear with emergency status?
Right. I mean, it's been a long time since we did those analyses, but the patients in whom LVEF is not available, it's not really necessarily missing, but it's not, you know, the test of ejection fraction has not been performed. That is typically those patients in whom you're under the gun to perform a primary angioplasty, so the DORTI of STEMI patients for whom we're trying to do a door-to-balloon time less than 90 minutes, oftentimes will forego doing an ejection fraction before the procedure. So from that standpoint, it is collinear with the urgency or emergency procedures. And that it sort of fits in that it's missing in about 10 to 20%, which is, I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact number, but that's the lion's share of one that's missing. It's not necessarily missing because the information was available and just not captured. I don't think that's what we're looking at here.
So by imputing it to essentially a normal value, which I believe is what you're doing, you are to some extent disadvantaging hospitals that are taking care of more emergencies compared to fewer emergencies.
No, because we have a dummy variable for missing information. In my understanding, I said that before, yeah, we have a category for LVEF
of, and I'm going to miss the actual specifications, but it's low EF, moderately low EF, normal EF, and missing EF. I think there are four or five categories for EF in the model. So missing information is not ignored.
So the continuous variable is moved to median, and there's an indicator as well, and we think it's probably redundant information somewhat with at least one other variable as well. So although it may not be perfect, it's probably less of a threat than it might at first sound like it is.
I will take back my original comment. I did not realize, or I didn't hear you when you said that you had an indicator variable for missing. So I would no longer qualify that as a significant threat to validity.
Paul?
I'll say that we have all this clinical data here that we have in a couple other measures, but most of the measures we've been talking about just have claims data. And we're talking about, you know, potentially even better risk prediction. So I think in the big scheme of things, any threats to validity are probably pretty small.
I'm not seeing any other cards raised, so I would just like to highlight, from my own understanding, to make sure, the real significant updates to the measure are that there were some changes in the CAP PCI registry variables, which warranted remodeling. There's an improved strategy for linkage, so that should again improve. I'm just thinking in terms of overall validity that. The first issue, the update to CATH registry data fields, you would expect to improve the validity overall, as Paul just hinted at. The improved linkage, we would expect to be an improvement overall. The planned readmission algorithm is an interesting aspect. You updated and more or less expanded the planned readmission algorithm such that, at least in summary, the end result was that the overall crude planned rate fell from 12.3% according to the prior algorithm to 11.8% according to the new algorithm. In other words, you're giving more institutions and providers more credit for readmissions being planned. And so we're minimizing, hopefully, we're minimizing or reducing the chance of falsely throwing a flag at them, perhaps at some cost, but that's what we're doing. The ICD crosswalk, not really an issue yet. And then updating your cohort code, again, appears to be an improvement to the overall validity of the measure. Any other? Yes, Sherry.
So you're not opposed to doing multiple imputation if we suggested that might be an enhancement to the missing data problem?
I don't see it as being a major barrier. I think that the vast majority of the information that's conveyed by missing LVEF is captured in that categorical variable of missing EF. And it is one of the more powerful coefficients in the model. But yes, we could certainly do that.
Well, I think as a small ask, maybe you could show in the future what some of the modeling looks like with and without in order to make the case of whether it's really worth the effort. Paul.
Oh, yeah, it just seems like that would be an NQF sort of policy if they want to make that one does multiple imputation whenever you're doing imputation. I would not recommend that, but it seems like rather than have the different groups suggested here and there, that should be a standard policy.
I understand that comment. I think NQF has shied away from saying that models have to be performed in a particular specific way. As we've seen modeling done in a number of different ways already. So I understand your comment, but I would hazard to guess that it will remain the judgment of the group as to whether a model is appropriately specified. Larry?
I think the issue really isn't single imputation versus multiple imputation. I think they're both fairly straightforward to carry out. There's not a huge difference in terms of doing that mechanistically. I think the issue is whether or not you should use an indicator approach versus an imputation-based approach. And I think there's a lot of literature which will show that estimates based on multiple imputation are less biased than those that are based on the indicator variable approach.
At the same time, Larry, with all due respect, that might be true of the imputed variable itself, but in this case, the variable probably is as part of a large number of variables in this model. The information value may be redundant, and in fact, there could be no value to multiply imputing versus the current approach.
So, agreed. We've actually done some of that research and have shown that there is a significant difference, at least in the population that we looked at. Whether or not that's generalizable to this population, I don't know. It's an empirical question.
Agree. We've done the same thing in NSQIP, so it's a common topic that people spend money on beer on. I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, so far what we've stated is that the current implementation seems to be a minimal threat. Other concerns or comments in this category of validity? Not seeing any.
Voting for 2B validity, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and your time starts now. We have all the votes for 2B validity. Two high, 18 moderate, zero low, and zero insufficient.
Feasibility. So this measure is based on a hybrid of clinical data and administrative data. The administrative data is just to identify which patients were readmitted. The clinical data is based on the CATH PCI registry. I would ask the measure developers to tell us what percentage of U.S. hospitals that are currently performing PCIs are in this particular registry.
So it's hard for us to get to an exact number, but based on what we
do, state your name, please.
Sorry, Laura Slattery. Based on what we, when we look at our participating facilities against American Hospital Association, we estimate about 85% of primary PCI hospitals are participating in the registry, but that it probably represents more about 90% of the patients because it tends to be smaller facilities, and usually smaller facilities where they have a state reporting requirement and no other incentive for them to join our registry that are the facilities that are not participating in.
In line with the STS measure that we looked at previously.
I don't know whether feasibility is the right category, but could the developers comment on improvements over time? This has been in play now for at least 3 years, is that right? Or
it's really only been in publicly reported last year, and so we don't really have good information about improvements over time. And in fact, as we've made these improvements to the model, moving to direct identifiers, there's been enough changes that I don't know if we have a good way of surveillance as to what's been going on even prior to public reporting. So it's probably still a little bit early for us to comment on.
Fair enough, but there's a very clear implementation plan, ongoing implementation. So it seems acceptable from that perspective. Other comments on feasibility from other group members? I don't see any.
Voting for 3 feasibility, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and your time starts now. We have all votes for feasibility. 6 high, 13 moderate, 1 low, and 0 insufficient.
Usability.
So I would ask the measure developers to provide us with information on how this information is reported to participating hospitals. Do you report it both as a continuous measure and also as a categorical measure, meaning high quality, low quality, and average quality? And if so, in the most current reporting period, what proportion of the hospitals were reported as being quality outliers?
So in the hospital-specific reports and actually in the public reporting, it's put both in buckets as well as the overall adjusted risk standardized rate. So they receive that information. In addition, in the hospital-specific reports, they receive information about what hospital, to what hospital the patient was readmitted, the principal diagnosis for that readmission, and the time frame of the dates of it. So we're trying to encourage through this hospital-specific report sort of cross-fertilization and crosstalk across hospitals so that they can try to work and improve these rates. In terms of the buckets, the calculation of the outliers was done completely in line with what's been done with the other CMS measures, and I believe it was about 2% of hospitals that were either high or low outliers, so relatively small number, in part because the data that we had available for the measure with the Social Security numbers in it that we needed to identify, we only had 2 years of data. So it was a little bit of probably a challenge in terms of having enough hospitals with enough volume that we could get really good discrimination as to putting them into categories, but not that far out of line for other publicly reported measures.
Was that 2% at each tail or 2% total?
I think it was 2% total.
Laura Slatter, I just wanted to clarify, hospitals receive the feedback report by virtue of participating in the registry regardless of whether they opted in for the public reporting component. So they all received the feedback reports. And the hospitals for which we had no data still received a benchmarking report just for information purposes only.
Additional comments or concerns on usability? Karen?
I know someone just said this, but is there any way to, or should we be thinking about ways to update the measure such that more than 2% can be identified as something? Or do you feel that the value is not about the identification as an outlier, but about the benchmarking?
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion in different forums all morning.
Do you know what happened to those that were identified? Like, can you look over the last 3 years and see what, prior to the reporting or identification as outliers, like sort of how your measure helps people move? Do you have any information on that?
Again, we've only had 1 year of public reporting, which was last March, and so we have not seen what's happened over time. And I think your work and others has questioned whether or not it does make a dramatic change as opposed to incremental change. And I think the jury's still out on how any of these measures can be used to change national performance. I think we are seeing encouraging trends, but nothing definite yet. But I think it is an implementation question as to where do you draw the buckets and where do you draw the line? Are you very restrictive or are you more permissive in terms of categorizing hospitals as better than or worse than? And again, we in this case tried to be as consistent as possible with other CMS measures.
Could the developers comment briefly on the unintended negative consequences remarks in the measure materials?
I mean, I think that as we've discussed for other measures, there's always the possibility of unintended consequences where you could have, at worst, case aversion on the basis of readmission rates. And that's really nothing that you can necessarily prophylax against. I think it's probably lower stakes for readmissions and procedures than it is perhaps for mortality. Just that would be my initial impression. But I think it's something that has to be monitored and can be monitored. And we've looked at, specifically for mortality, we've been looking at whether or not expected case mix and predicted risk has changed over time in states that publicly report PCI mortality and have not seen dramatic changes in the expected mortality at states that do have public reporting.
Other thoughts or concerns on usability? Seeing none.
Voting for usability and use, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient information, and the time starts now. 3 more votes.
Could everybody do it one more time? Sorry.
We have all the votes for usability and use. 3 high, 14 moderate, 3 low, and 0 insufficient information.
Any comments in summary before an overall vote? I see Karen.
I just have another clarifying question. You can tell I've not been on this committee before. This came up with another measure yesterday that we were reapproving or whatever. Is the burden of proof that it is that it has been implemented or that it has made X amount of change, or what is the sort of – what is our responsibility in terms of looking at its longitudinal performance in continuing it forward?
I'll give my opinion on that, but I'll be corrected if I'm wrong. I think when there's a clear plan for ongoing implementation, that's kind of step one. And if that plan has been and is being carried out in good faith but may not have results yet, I think that should meet our adequacy threshold. That's my opinion.
Just to add to that, last year Karen had to leave, but she led an effort with a task force to update our use and usability criterion. It used to just be usability, which basically was it in use. And I think what we really heard from the community, that's not enough. So in use is really important, and by the 3-year window, we want to see that it's being used in an accountability application within 2 of those cycles. We want to see evidence of public reporting. But I think increasingly what we're trying to see is, in addition to that, and this is not a must-pass like evidence and scientific acceptability, but we want to, in fact, be able to see over time that measures in use have helped to move the needle, hopefully positively, but we also want to be cautious, as we've talked a lot about over the last couple of days, that we also haven't seen any unintended consequences as a result of that use. So it's something we'd love your input on. This is really just, I think, the first year that we've actually implemented the broader lens on use and usability. So Bruce got it right.
Can I just follow up? I mean, I think there are different ways that you can measure impact. I think when we developed this measure, nobody was talking or thinking about readmissions after PCI, and certainly the whole healthcare system has really evolved in their consideration of the importance of this particular aspect for pros and cons and differences of opinion. It's out there. I can say that over the past 5 years since we published our first paper in JACC just describing the readmission rates, there has been an abundance of literature coming out examining the issue. So I think we have moved the conversation on this. The next will be to see, can we move the actual rates?
The notion that you're only calling out, going back to one of Karen's earlier remarks, that you're only calling out a percent or so at each tail, do you have any internal plans or deliberations around changing that as potentially a way to drive change faster?
So let me throw that out. I think we are going to be cautious as an organization in terms of how we call out hospitals. And I think that the real value for me is in reporting this information back to hospitals, that they get their risk standardized rates, that they have, that they're valid, that they're believable, and that they are usable. And the usable is, I think, what needs to evolve most rapidly. I have spent the last 4 years of my life, in addition to working on this measure, working on developing the evidence that will support reducing these readmission rates. And we are in the last stages of a mixed method study, understanding both the qualitative and quantitative strategies associated with lower readmission rates. So I think what the ACC and what we're talking about, and I'm not going to guarantee that this will be done because I don't speak for them in that regard, but we're trying to create an environment where we will take that evidence, combine it with this information, and create a campaign or an effort to try and systematically reduce these rates at hospitals. And I think much more so than identifying high and low outliers, that's the way we're going to push things forward. You have to develop the evidence. You have to package it up in a toolkit or some other change
some process that promotes change in a positive force, much more so than putting them in buckets.
And so if I can just add to Dr. Curtis's remarks, which are totally in line and I agree with, this is our first foray out with a measure that the hospitals were offered the opportunity to publicly report on. The college has a larger portfolio within PCI, but also this year we will be implementing it in the ICD, implantable cardioverter defibrillator, and we do have plans to expand public reporting opportunities for our hospitals across our registry initiative. So once we start to look at that contextually, we want to ensure consistency in how we report the information out. So we actually, it's a separate work group that is taking that on, and we'll be working through those approaches, and we will likely evolve it over time. But I agree, it's meant to drive quality improvement and be engaging in dialogue and useful consumers. So it's hard to balance out all of those.
Thank you. Larry?
I would just like to add my thoughts on this discussion. I think that the burden on showing that there is an improvement in population outcomes with a quality measure should not rest primarily with the measure developer. I think that as long as the quality of the information that's being provided in a quality metric is deemed to be acceptable or high, then it really is up to the end user to use that information to improve population outcomes. So I think we should be hesitant about looking for improvement in population outcomes as a determining factor in whether or not a quality metric is usable or not usable.
Christy?
Just a clarifying question on the public reporting, because you said it just a couple of times. Is this a voluntary public reporting on behalf of the hospitals? And if so, about what percentage of those who are reporting are actually being willing to be voluntarily reported publicly?
That's a great question. Yes, it is a completely voluntary public reporting. And if hospitals opted out, there was no indication that they'd opted out. So it was simply those hospitals that opted in, at least on Hospital Compare. Of the, I think, 1,200 hospitals that had met our reporting thresholds, 350 roughly decided to participate. I will say personally that was about 320 more than I thought were going to be willing to do it. So I thought for an initial year's effort for voluntary public reporting, it was very successful.
I'll also just to, since we talked a little bit about implementation and you want to understand where we're going with it, I think that that's incredibly admirable of the hospitals that opted in, because one of the things that for you to understand is we went from providing the reports to the hospitals to giving them a window of about 6 to 8 weeks to make a decision to voluntarily report. The lion's share of those 300 and some odd hospitals opted in at that point. There was only one other opportunity for those hospitals to opt in to have it publicly reported, and that's why the number is stable. Dr. Curtis also referenced the fact that that if you chose not to report, there's nothing reflected on Hospital Compare. Moving forward, the ACC has made the decision that we will be making it more obvious to consumers if a hospital is participating in our registries and had the opportunity to be able to report that and elected not to, and then differentiating some of the categories of decision-making and displaying that information out. So moving forward, there will be more of that. And moving forward, we will continue to partner with CMS on reporting this data on Hospital Compare, because we think that that is a very valuable resource for consumers. We also will have a complementary effort within our organization, and the reason for doing that is it allows for a mechanism for more rapid dissemination of information. So right now, data gets reported to Hospital Compare on a quarterly basis. The infrastructure we will put in place on our website will allow that as soon as a hospital makes a decision to publicly report, it will be made available to the public, and we can control the infrastructure better to be able to do that.
Do you know if the performance distribution in the reporting group is different than in the overall group?
Yes.
But we did have some.
Is there a concern that the public is getting the wrong impression?
So we did have those, some of the low-performing hospitals opt in for voluntarily publicly reporting. I mean, again, I do think that in fairness to them, the window of opportunity for which to make a decision was incredibly tight. So even for the second sweep, they at best had about 12 weeks to make a decision, get leadership buy-in within their organization, get legal counsel to review it, and get the paperwork back to us for it to appear. So it's going to be, we think that moving forward over time, it'll be easier for hospitals to get on board with this.
Thank you. Sherry.
So follow on to Larry's comment, and that is sensitivity to change is one of these awkward things where you don't know what actually manipulations were going on that your measure should be responsive to. So the attribution to sensitivity to change implies efforts to quality improve where you don't know what those are. It could be, and especially at the tails where we are the worst at estimating where a hospital actually might be. The regression of the mean pops to mind, and you can chuckle around the tails without actually having a response to change. So is there any effort, and distributional scoring will always have this property, somebody always loses. So is there any push towards trying to find the mutable point beyond which a threshold one would declare a hospital as either better or worse or whatever, or is there any effort along those lines to shift away from distributional scoring?
Yeah, I think it's a great question and something that the field as a whole, I think, continues to struggle with, and I think we always default to the distributional because it's comfortable and familiar. I think for readmission specifically, we don't know what the floor is, and I think until we kind of know and they start bunching up on the lower side, I think it's reasonable to use the distributional but be attuned to the fact that since we know that there are unplanned readmissions that are not preventable, that the goal is not to go to zero.
Larry. I have one last comment. Since our discussion now is about endorsement, I'd like to point out that this, like many of the other measures that we have looked at over the last 2 days, is, I believe, a very robust measure, methodologically speaking. What differentiates this measure from many of the other measures that we've looked at is that this particular measure is largely based on clinical as opposed to administrative data. And I think that's really a very, very important qualifier because clinical data is believed by most to be much more accurate and therefore have much greater face validity compared to administrative data.
Thank you. Same comments we had about ESTS discussion earlier on. Yeah, Jephthah.
Not to shoot chart-based measures in the foot, but I do think it's important to recognize that they have different strengths. And I think that, yes, we're really good at knowing whether or not a patient has diabetes and what the creatinine was and things like that, and that is important in terms of risk adjustment. We're not as good as an administrative model, I don't think, at measuring frailty and accounting for frailty in a robust fashion. So I appreciate the support, and I hope that it's taken into account, but I think there are two different schools of thought, and there are competing strengths.
Thank you. I see no cards up, so let's move to vote overall.
Voting for overall suitability for endorsement, 1 yes, 2 no, and time starts now. Two more votes. One more.
There's some empty chairs down at the end of the table.
All votes are in. For overall suitability for endorsement, for measure 0695, hospital 30-day risk standardized readmission rates following percutaneous coronary intervention, 20 yes, 0 no.
We thank the developers and we'll ask the ALCMS teams to come back to the table for the next measure.
Okay. Welcome to the developer. I'd ask you to do what we've been doing, which is briefly introduce yourself, and then and also, as soon as you speak, remind you, please say again your names because the recorder back in the corner can't see you, and then briefly introduce your measure.
Great. Hi, this is Susanna Bernheim. I'm a director of quality measurement for the Yale Core team, many of whom you have met today. Nihar, do you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Nihar Desai. I'm a cardiologist at Yale and an investigator at the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation.
Do you have anyone on the phone?
I don't know that we have anyone on the phone. Do we have anyone on the phone? We have some support in the back.
Okay.
And CMS here, but I don't believe that there's anybody on the phone for this measure. Okay, so I will just say a couple of words about this measure. This is a 30-day all-cause unplanned readmissions for hospitalizations, following hospitalizations with an acute myocardial infarction. This measure originally came to NQF in 2008, and this is its first time back for full reendorsement, which is a little longer than usual just because of the cycles of projects. It has been in public reporting through the Inpatient Quality Reporting Program since 2009, and last year was included in the first year of the Hospital Readmission Reduction Program. It is designed much like our other measures. We look at a cohort of AMI patients. We look at readmissions 30 days later. I will talk a little bit about the planned readmission algorithm in a moment to identify unplanned readmissions. It uses the same hierarchical modeling approach as our other measures, and it is a claims-based measure. There have been a number of changes over the years. They're detailed in in the application. I'll just highlight the important ones. When it first was reported, we moved from a one-year measure to a three-year measure because many hospitals do not have a huge volume of AMI cases, and that allowed us to report on a greater number of hospitals. Other key changes, early on we excluded patients who were discharged against medical advice. That's true now with all of the readmission measures. In reporting, I believe 2 years ago, this measure was expanded to include data from VA hospitals. So in the public reported measure, it's now all CMS hospitals and patients hospitalized originally with their AMI at a VA hospital. So that was a neat collaboration between CMS and the VA, which took a fair amount of work. And then the one other big change has been that as part of the development of our hospital-wide readmission measure, which this committee is going to be talking about later, we created an algorithm that used claims codes to try to define readmissions that were planned or likely to be scheduled in advance, largely procedural readmissions that were not associated with an acute diagnosis code. And there's a long algorithm that does that, and we developed that first in a hospital-wide cohort, and then we carefully checked it against the condition-specific cohorts. And last year, NQF held an ad hoc review of our condition-specific measures, including this measure, just to look more closely at this planned readmission algorithm. So that piece of this measure has come before a committee at NQF previously, but the whole measure hadn't come back at that point for reendorsement. I think an interesting case was made earlier that improvement doesn't prove that the measure works or not, but I will say, because we're really excited about it, that in the three-year cycle that was reported last December, we are seeing for the first time declining national AMI readmission rates, and that's in the context of also decreasing admissions for AMI and potentially higher severity admissions and big declines in mortality. And so I think we're very reassured around questions of unintended consequences that the decline in readmission is happening in the context of other improvements around AMI. I think that's probably enough of a quick overview for all of you who know this measure well, but obviously we'll answer whatever questions you have.
Thank you very much. Paul, do you want to go first on the evidence?
Yes, I think there's, we don't necessarily have a lot of evidence to know exactly how hospitals are improving. Clearly in 2012, there was a sudden drop in readmissions for MI, as well as most hospitalizations for Medicare patients. So I think there's clearly a strong rationale that that one could make improvements.
Larry? Nothing to add? Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for 1A, evidence. 1 is yes, 2 is no, and your time begins now. We're just waiting. Okay, all votes are in for 1A evidence, 19 yes, 0 no.
Great. Performance gap?
So that has narrowed, but I think still remains important. It went from, I think, the 10%, 90% went from 17.9 to 19.4 several years ago, and it looks like where the last draw was down to 17.3 and 18.3, so the higher end clearly dropped, although still a reasonable difference between the groups, and the overall rate, some might argue, is still too high. So I'd say there is a significant evidence performance gap.
Larry? Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for 1B, performance gap. 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and the time begins now. Just one more vote. All votes are in for 1B performance gap. 9 high, 10 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you very much. Priority?
It has been, I think, probably still remains a priority for the government, for CMS, you know, to improve readmission rates for MI.
Larry? Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for 1C, high priority. 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and the time begins now. All votes are in for 1C, high priority. 14 high, 5 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Scientific acceptability, reliability. Paul?
So I think this has been felt to be moderate. I think they used a test retest with a random sample, and we see a reported ICC of 0.38, which is, you know, I think, relatively common for this type of data.
Larry? Other comments? Ready to vote? Oh, you have a comment.
I just wanted to clarify, it was brought up in the cabbage just because people had taken some interest in this. We did do some work because when we create these ICCs, we're not using 6 years of data to get a 3-year sample size, right? So as Lisa explained earlier, we put together a correction factor, and we can share those details. And when you do that for this measure, it goes up to 0.48, just so people know. It's stronger, our best estimate of what it would be with a full 3-year sample size.
It's certainly well within what we've been seeing. So it's not exactly like this is a huge departure, but thank you for that clarification.
Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for 2A, reliability. 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, and 4 insufficient, and the time starts now. All votes are in for 2A, reliability. 3 voted high, 16 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Validity, Paul?
Yes, there's been, I think, with the original submission, I'm not sure if things were updated, but the model, the overall model's discrimination had C statistics close to 0.6, I think slightly under. It was, sounds like, interestingly, it was, I think, when it was tested in the CCP project, which had actual chart review, it sounded like there was very similar C statistics. So it didn't seem like you were losing a whole lot from using, or if any at all, of using administrative data. So that seems to be, I think, very reasonable for this type of data. I think the exclusions are, as described, are reasonable. I don't think there's been, if anything, the slight changes over time have improved the model since it was last approved. I didn't feel there are any significant issues with missing data, but we'll see if anyone else has concerns.
Larry? Can you clarify the C statistic for us? Because I want to make sure everybody understands.
That.
I know you're not asking.
What the magnitude of it.
Sure. So you were right. When it was first developed, the technical report from development, I think it was 0.58. In the most recent year of data, we look at it each time it gets run. The most recent 3 years, it was 0.64.
Oh, and I actually remember, I did have one question. I know it's been then tested in California data, so now you can have an 18 and over measure. But it wasn't clear to me if there was a significant improvement or decrease in the model's performance.
So that's a great question that I don't remember the answer to. In general, our measures often do slightly better in the all-payer data sets. We think that's because the comorbidities are even more powerful predictors in younger populations that have fewer of them. And I can quickly find you the answer for this particular one. It is. So 0.67 was the discrimination for the 18 and over measure, and the correlation between the two was 0.998. Larry?
So just as a quick point of clarification, as was alluded, it's very common to see a model perform differently in different data sets, and specifically, if you're going to use an all-payer data set, you expect to see more heterogeneity in the patient population, and therefore, as a result of that, you'll see better discriminatory power.
Thank you. Other comments? Ready to... Frank.
What was the impact of expanding the planned readmission algorithm?
Great question. Again, numbers I don't have at the tip of my tongue. It reduces the overall readmission rate very slightly, although for this measure, let's see if I can find it rapidly for you. I'm going to look up your head where this is. It should be in the section on.
So refreshing to see people turn pages as opposed to scroll.
Right, exactly, not be on a screen. Planned readmission algorithm, I don't say here. If somebody on the phone from our team has this handy, please speak up, and I will otherwise find it quickly, but it'll take me just a minute. Can the operator open the line to make sure that somebody on our team is available to answer this question quickly, because they probably have it at their fingertips quicker than I do?
What are their names? Some of the people that are on the phone?
Susanna?
Oh.
Kanchanabat, are you there? Can you?
Our lines are open.
Okay, great. Anybody on the Yale team have this number handy quickly so I don't have to make this poor entire committee wait for just flip pages?
Hi, this is Lori Gere at Yale. Can you hear me?
Yes.
We are pulling that up now. Bear with us 1 minute.
The easiest place may be the NQF application when we brought it back last year.
Okay. From version 1 to version 2, it went from 19.7 to 19.0. I'm sorry, 18.7.
Okay, so a percentage point. We should have just gone with my guess. I was right. Thank you, Lori.
Okay.
Thanks for that clarification. Any other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for 2B, validity, 1 is high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and your time begins now. All votes are in for 2B, validity. 4 high, 15 moderate, 0 low, and 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Feasibility?
Based on claims data, highly feasible.
Larry, agree. Other comments? Ready to vote?
Voting for feasibility, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time starts now. All votes are in for feasibility. 18 high, 1 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Usability and use, Paul?
Well, it already is being used, and, you know, one could argue it's been successful, given that it's been used both, I think, for public reporting as well as for payment, and we've seen the expected changes, at least within 2012.
Okay. All right, great. I have one quick question. If it were possible, would it be possible to investigate actually the sensitivity to places where you actually knew there were efforts underway to improve this, and so responsiveness to change could actually be estimated?
But, so I think what you're asking is, could we focus in on places that we know are making a big effort around this and show that those efforts are playing out? I mean, I think that's a great research question. It's not something we've done on our team, but I think it is an important link that the research is slowly building to show. You know, there are some trials out there that have shown particular interventions work with AMI patients.
Thank you. That raises the specter of the R word, so we're moving on really quickly. So for usability and use, are there any other? Sorry, Karen.
I think this is a great example of ways in which the same measure can be used a lot of different ways. In the way that it's used in public reporting, of the 4,464 hospitals in the U.S., 23 are identified as being better than average, 2,327 are no different, 29 are worse, and 2,085 are number of cases too small. That's a lot of effort for hospitals to make for this amount of discrimination, and I know they get more information than this. On the completely opposite side is the way that the readmissions penalty is calculated, in which there's no uncertainty built into the model. If you're 0.001% worse than predicted on dollars, not even on rates, that you will in theory get a penalty. And I don't know that there's any way in this committee to address the different ways in which something can be used, but it certainly points out that the statistical arguments that we have about the way that this thing is done can go any number of different ways when things are put forward. And to me, the way that things are used actually is really important to how the measure is going to work. And I might personally choose different ways of calculating this based on whether it's going to be used for public reporting or for pay-for-performance or whatever this is going to be. So I just have concerns about this sort of blanket blessing of measures when they can be used in such vastly different ways. That may be a bigger problem in this particular measure, but I think I'd be interested in hearing from the developers sort of how we should think about what your model can do. The data to suggest exactly what you're saying, which is what we know can and can't work to improve readmissions, is not great. And I'd be interested in knowing from your work, are the people that are identified as outliers doing something differently? What's happening as a result of the way that this metric is being used?
Hold on a second.
Yeah, I mean, a couple things are that, Karen, your sentiment is a longstanding one. It's been heard in many, many NQF forums over the years. And, in fact, I think I won't jump the gun, but in the upcoming white paper coming out from NQF, there may be some commentary about NQF increasing its guidance around recommended uses or uses where a particular measure seems most appropriate. So we won't change that aspect of it today, but your sentiment has been heard many, many times.
And if this needs to be tabled, I'm totally fine with that. I'm struggling a little bit with the sort of the questions around usability for us to sort of say,
yeah,
as it's being used, what are the negative consequences, what's happened, and we don't really get that.
Absolutely,
data,
and that's been
presented.
I think we all sympathize. That's absolutely been the case. But if there is something you would like our developers to state, please rephrase that. I didn't want to cut you off, but I do want you to know that that is a longstanding concern, and there may be some change in the air around that concern, but it won't happen today. Is there anything you do want the developers to say? Okay. Any other comments or concerns then?
Just to say that some of us share your pain. and the hopefully MAP group will begin to address these kinds of issues. So there's a safety clause built in, but it's not sufficient for some of us to kind of feel cozy about these decisions. Okay.
Suzanne.
I will decline from commenting on the pieces that you guys want not commented on. I just wanted to make sure that people know that a part of the work that we do with CMS is explicitly monitoring for unintended consequences, and we do some surveillance work. And there is a constant measure maintenance process. So just in terms of the unintended consequences piece, that is a part of the expectation as part of the measure life cycle.
Thanks for that clarification. Any other comments? Are we ready to vote usability and use? Okay.
Voting for usability and use, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient information, and the time starts now. All votes are in for usability and use. 4 high, 14 moderate, 0 low, and 1 insufficient information.
Thank you very much. Moving on to suitability for endorsement. Paul?
I think no additional comments. I'd say it meets endorsement in my opinion.
Larry?
I think this measure is also very typical of most of the CMS measures that we've heard and other measures. It's very robust in terms of the methodology, and I would also vote for endorsement.
This is Washington, so I won't say robustitude in this audience, but it does. So we are voting on its suitability for endorsement. Ready to vote?
Voting on overall suitability for endorsement, 1 yes, 2 no. Time starts now. All votes are in for overall suitability for endorsement for measure 0505, hospital 30-day all-cause risk standardized readmission rate following acute myocardial infarction hospitalization. The results are 17 yes, 2 no.
Thank you. Thank you to the Yale group.
We'll invite the next Yale group to the table. We'll be discussing 2539, 7-day risk standardized hospital visit rate after outpatient colonoscopy. I think in some senses a little bit of a twist compared to some other topics we've discussed. So we'll wait for our developers. No, that was not a pun. In the room right now. So we have 18 people in the room. No one's permitted to leave because we lose our quorum. So raise your hand if you do have to do a number one. Raise your
hand. Does anybody have a slide?
It could be done by 2, I think.
We'll continue to push on. Our colleagues from Yale. Please introduce yourselves and your measure.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Dry from Yale. I was just going to say, following up on Bruce's point, that this is a little bit of a twist. This is the first measure we're bringing to NQF for outcome of ambulatory care. So we're really excited about it as new terrain. And Isiru led the work, and he's going to walk us through.
Okay. So it's Isiru here again. I'll start off by doing a quick summary of the measure and the rationale for the measure. So this measure is a measure of unplanned hospital visits following outpatient colonoscopy, and that is colonoscopies performed in hospital outpatient department, ambulatory surgical centers, and physician office settings. The denominator for this measure is low or moderate risk colonoscopy procedures. And based on our inclusion and exclusion criteria, we actually capture about 94% of all our patient colonoscopies performed. the numerator for this measure is unplanned hospital visits within 7 days of the procedure. And hospital visits include ED admissions, observation stays, and inpatient admissions. Now, that's a very broad patient-centered outcome that captures adverse events that are related to the bowel prep, the anesthesia itself, and the procedure. Now, this measure is really important because of four critical reasons, and I'll outline them. First is that colonoscopy is incredibly common. So this is the most common procedure performed in the outpatient setting. We see an outcome rate of about 16.2 per thousand procedures in the Medicare data, and we see significant variation between 8 to 20 per thousand between providers. So there is a facility-level variation in quality. The key, and if you extrapolate that to national data, that's about 27,000 hospital visits following colonoscopy procedures nationally. And that's really important because most of these procedures, we know two-thirds to three-quarters are screening colonoscopies. So by definition, these are procedures occurring in relatively healthy people who don't have signs or symptoms of the disease. And ensuring monitoring quality in that group is there's a strong mandate for measuring quality. We also know when we look at the top diagnosis that many of these patients come back in with both serious and very mild things and potentially preventable things, things like abdominal pain, nausea, bloating, bleeding, perforation, syncope, aspiration because of the anesthesia. So we think these are really important things to measure and potentially preventable. The key thing with this is many of these providers in the outpatient setting are completely unaware of these events. They're simply invisible. So, for example, there's a study from Boston that suggests about 80% of these visits the providers are actually unaware of. And you can understand that. So if you're an ASC, ambulatory surgical center, you're legally not allowed to provide follow-up care. You can understand why patients would present to a different provider if in the event of an adverse event. So we think this measure is really important for eliminating quality. And if I can finish by very quickly saying that this measure was developed with input from a working group that can, we had input from Dr. Ron Bender and John Allen, who are heads of the American Gastroenterology Association and the American College of Gastroenterology. We're extremely fortunate to have them, and they had a huge input into shaping this measure. We're also very lucky to have a highly qualified technical expert panel, which provide us great insights into this measure, and a period of public comment, which we addressed many of the issues that came up. And I must say, overwhelmingly, this measure has been supported by that group. We think that provides a lot of rationale. This measure uses Medicare data, so it's eminently feasible. It's risk-adjusted. It uses a hierarchy model. We can statistically determine the outliers. And just lastly, we submitted this measure for approval to MAP during the development process, and we've received conditional approval from them.
And just immediately clarifying, the accountable entity is the outpatient department or the ambulatory surgery center.
That's right.
All right. So thank you for that introduction to the measure. We're in the category of evidence. We'll ask Ross and or Christy if they would like to open the discussion.
Sure, I can start here. That's okay with you, Christy?
Please.
Okay, good. Evidence, you've already alluded to some of the evidence, but there's not a lot. This is a new measure. I think you mentioned four reasons why this is important. I'd add a fifth one. When I need my colonoscopy, I don't want a complication. So that's important to everybody because this is our general population. If you live long enough, you should have one of these. The evidence that is literature reviewed shows complication rates from 20 to 34%, and then you did have on HCUP data, unplanned hospital visits ranging from 8.3 to 20.1 per thousand colonoscopies.
That's right.
And I think there's some evidence out there, although it's light at this point in time for the evidence. Christine?
No, just that you all did document at least some of the interventions that you thought would be possible to actually improve upon the measures. So from my perspective, it meets the evidence for a health outcome.
Any other comments or concerns? We'll consider this an intermediate outcome for now. No other comments, no cards. Let's vote on evidence.
Voting for 1A, evidence. 1 is yes, 2 no. Time starts now. One more vote. All votes are in for 1A, evidence. 14 yes, 4 no.
Performance gap opportunity.
There does appear to be variability in performance. The standardized range was from 8.3 to 20.1, so there seems to be quite an opportunity for improvement.
Additional comments?
I agree. No other comment.
Let's move to vote.
Voting for 1B, performance gap, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient. Time starts now.
Let's try again.
All votes are in for 1B performance gap. 7 high, 11 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient.
Priority.
This is a U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation, as was talked about, since we're recommending that people go get this as a screening test, that we have an obligation to be sure they're getting a high quality. I think I was impressed by the 14 million colonoscopies that were done back in 2004 alone. So a very high frequency procedure that needs to have the quality measured.
Additional comments?
Agree.
No additional comments?
Voting for 1C, high priority, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and your time begins now. All votes are in for 1C, high priority. The results are 12 high, 6 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient.
Thank you. Moving into scientific acceptability, reliability.
The reliability was on a 2010 split arm population of large numbers of colonoscopies, and I believe your the ICC on that was 0.335 judged as fair. And I think that's the information provided. Is that correct?
Correct. We did, as you heard on our other measures, we have recalculated that with the Spearman round prophecy formula.
interesting name. And it's at 0.43. That gives us a better estimate if we had a full data set. I would just note, I think as you're all aware, the outcome rates for this measure are lower than they are for example, AMI readmission. And so we have to get a bigger sample size to get reliable measure score results, and we're happy with what we're seeing here, but this is an inherent challenge in a healthier population with a high volume of procedures but a lower outcome rate.
Any additional comments or concerns on reliability? Seeing none.
Voting for 2A, reliability, 1 high, 2 moderate, 3 low, 4 insufficient, and the time starts now. I need one more vote, please. All votes are in for 2A reliability. The results are 1 high, 17 moderate, 0 low, 0 insufficient.
Moving into validity, opening remarks.
Okay, on validity, you had your technical expert panel that drove a lot of, I think, the validity questions as I read through your information. In addition, you had split sample, 2 years of data, and on that, C statistics of 0.67, and your conclusions were that this is good model discrimination. The other piece of information that you provided that I'd like to have you comment on is the Charleston model. Better than Charleston model, and I believe this is your risk stratification tool, and Elix-Hauser model of your C statistics actually being better than those as a risk model. Would you comment, please?
So this is Rana Singh here again. So we did two things. One was that we compared the C statistics between the development and a validation sample and a then again, in using data, so we developed our data using the 2010 sample, and then we validated it again in the 2011 sample. The other validation step we did was to construct the risk adjustment model using, we constructed a risk adjustment model based on our conceptual and statistical understanding of what we thought will predict hospital visits in this population. But we wanted to benchmark against a risk model that's already been used, and one option was to use the Charleston and the Elix-Hauser models, which are widely accepted. Please keep in mind, Charleston and Elix-Hauser are not gastroenterology specific or not colonoscopy specific. In fact, the Elix-Hauser model was to predict mortality, from what I understand. But we thought this would give us a good idea of where our model sits, and our C statistics and the model characteristics actually ended up being better than both those models.
This is Elizabeth Stry. I would just add that, again, we're in a novel data environment in a novel setting. We don't have other, you know, there's not like 5 or 10 other readmission measures or similar measures we can compare it to. So even though we were hoping with thoughtful variable selection with a lot of clinical input that we would do better than these indices, we felt we should at least use some other approach to make sure we were getting what we thought we should be getting.
Karen?
I just have a few additional questions. One is, I know there's not a lot of other quality measures in this group, but is there anything else you can compare this to? Do we know if procedure volume matters for colonoscopy, the rate of detection of abnormality? I know has been proposed as a quality. Is there anywhere else to sort of externally validate whether or not the rates that you're seeing are indicative of bad procedure as opposed to sick patient?
It's here again. It's a great question, and one that we find really challenging because really there is no outcome measures, full stop, for many of the ambulatory procedures, and we didn't really know what to compare against. And we, in fact, the conclusion we reached was that there is no measure that we could adequately compare against. The only sort of measure that comes close is the NQF measure, that's NQF approved measure for ambulatory surgical centers, which does a immediate transfer following the procedure. But at the time, we didn't have the actual reported part, those values, individual hospital level values were not reported for that measure for us to compare against.
I would just add also that, Elizabeth Dry, again, we relied heavily on looking at the reasons for the ED visits, observation stays, and readmission, and just thinking clinically, you know, are these likely to be just sick patients, or are they, you know, do they look like they're related? And also we know we're dealing with a patient group and a procedure that typically would not be done in an outpatient setting on patients who were acutely ill for other reasons. We did pull out of the measure those patients who we felt might end up in the hospital for the reason for which they were having the colonoscopy. So IBD, inflammatory bowel disease patients, patients with history of diverticulitis are pulled out of the measure. We did a lot. We had a lot of discussion around that and comment on that issue. And we also pull out of the outcome admissions for planned care like colorectal resection, and that's a third of all hospital admissions that we see following colonoscopy. So we tried to triangulate or whatever, get at that concern in a number of different ways. We also looked at the baseline admission rates, and we looked at the fall off in the first few days to try to pick the outcome time frame. And we're confident that we are zeroing in on hospital visits that are really related to the procedure versus patient factors that we're not adjusting for, but it took a lot of different strategies.
Sherry?
I was just going to sort of notice, and this is not for slowing the conversation down or anything, but different from the dialysis measure where the attribution was back to the hospital, right, for readmission to the hospital.
It was to the dialysis center,
so then it does follow the same issue. So the skill in that case of the colonoscopist, so confounded with center, at that time there was some discussion about the interest of the physician level stuff and the potential for estimating things that were attributing things to the outpatient center versus the providers, and there was some conversation around that, and I don't want to stir up a storm here, but I did want to kind of, for fairness of comparison, raise that issue.
Actually in a similar place, because we're assuming that the facility has some impact on quality and it's not just the operator's skill or proficiency.
That's a great issue. I think it's come up before. The reason that we put the measure at the facility level, there's a couple of reasons. One, there is a component of the facility care that we think contributes to the outcome. There's the anesthesia care. There's the post-op care. There's decision about when the patient is ready to go home. These facilities, a lot of them, particularly ambulatory surgery centers, are physician-owned, and they tend to specialize, and they may have a couple of physicians who regularly work there. But in general, the physicians do colonoscopies in multiple settings too. So if you wanted to do look at volume, you know, at the facility related to ALK, you might not necessarily be getting at the volume you were trying to capture, which would be the per physician, at least for the physician component. And we're confident, given the nature of things that we see people go back to the hospital for, that there's a facility component, and we expect that there's a consistency of which physicians are doing the care where. But we also, as I mentioned before, we need to get a certain volume of patients and outcomes to be able to get a reliable estimate. So for all those reasons, we housed it at the facility level. Like the other measure, this measure would be, if it's implemented by CMS, would be implemented in the hospital outpatient department. Hospital outpatient prospective OPPS system, as well as under the ambulatory surgery center program. So they have not had this type of measure, as far as I know, implemented there, and we have encouraged CMS to follow the approach that is taken for the hospital-based measures, in which facilities get patient-level data. They can see
which patients are in the measure and where they ended up, which are things they won't otherwise see, and we think that's going to be really critical, and they will be able to see in there who the physician was, who the anesthesiologist was, et cetera.
Paula?
Does this include immediate admission to either OBS, or is there a 24-hour lag?
So this includes direct admissions from ASCs or from HOPDs, hospital outpatient departments. And the rationale was that this is, colonoscopy procedures should be straightforward procedures, range from 30 minutes to an hour. There's really no reason for the patient to stay for an extended length of time unless some sort of adverse event occurs.
So there are those patients who have no ride, even, and we've seen those, but it's not a large percent.
Frank?
I was wondering if you had data in regards to how did you come up with the seven days for this type of procedure, and the side effect that you're describing, trying to capture 7 days, actually seems a little bit long. You think in the first day, 2 days, maybe 3 days. Out 7 days, you're probably looking at continuation of symptoms and things like that. So I wonder if you had data specifically to support your cutoff of 7.
So that's a great question. So the range of side effects that could occur after a colonoscopy, and they range from within a few days for things like perforation, but up to 30 days for things like bleeding, GI bleeding. And so there's a definite phenomenon of delayed GI bleeding. We know from the literature that vast majority of those complications, adverse events, occur within the first 7 days. And we can empirically test that by looking at the number of hospital visits per each day post-procedure. And what we see is a curve which sort of levels off after about 7 days. And that's why we picked the 7-day time window, because we thought that would give us the best sort of quality signal for our measure. And that was supported by our technical expert panel. It does mean that we miss some bleeding events that are delayed, but we specifically excluded them because we did not want to capture hospital events that are unrelated to the procedure.
Wes?
Yeah, a couple of comments to Sherry's point and then one question. The comments, hopefully we'll see many outpatient measures in the future. So, and I think this one actually has a pretty elegant design. But to Sherry's analogy, one of the things I like about this is that they work pretty hard at the development level to identify what's essentially a well population. So that's quite different than the standard dialysis patient who's by definition chronically ill. The other is this is pretty much of a one-to-one linkage between the physician doing the colonoscopy and then the procedure and the outcome. And that's not necessarily true at dialysis centers in terms of who's actually providing the service and whether it's a passive or active physician activity. But one question about the design measure. I'm just sort of curious why you chose not to include follow-up, unscheduled follow-up with the primary care physician or clinic during the first 7 days.
So that's a great question. So it's very, firstly, we considered all outcomes that are possible. We felt the acute care use or visit to a hospital is something that's unexpected following a colonoscopy procedure. And so that we thought we reflected a clear quality signal, whereas a visit to a primary care provider could be plan, could be appropriate care, could be scheduled care, and that's very hard for us to identify from claims data. And that is, I guess, the primary reason.
You okay with that, Wes?
Well, I'm very okay with it, and for Helen and many other people around the table, I think the measure developers make the point that there are many situations where a component of primary care or first contact care can happen someplace besides the primary care clinician's practice. And that's part of why I'm fundamentally uncomfortable, along with 30,000 of my close friends in emergency medicine, with the implied negative metric that goes along with ED visits and many other measures.
Point well taken. Ross?